DD councils are federally funded, and therefore the appropriations process is central to the work that we do here in Washington, D.C. President Trump has signed a continuing resolution, which allows for 8 additional weeks of funding past the current budget deadline. So right now we are funded through November 21st. Hopefully Congress can pass their appropriations bills between now and then, so there will not be any more subsequent CRs. However, the focus on impeachment might complicate and delay matters. And timing does matter. Congress is currently working on a 2-week break from Washington, D.C. for the district work period. When they return on October 15th, they'll have just 30 days remaining in session. House Democrats have already said that they're hoping to continue impeachment inquiries of President Trump and hopefully come to a vote by Thanksgiving. If they succeed in voting to impeach, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he's required by the Senate rules to take up articles of impeachment and hold a trial. There are 6 House committees currently working on this impeachment inquiry. I'm telling you this because this means dozens of members of Congress will undoubtedly be distracted from their work on appropriations and focusing on the impeachment inquiry. Optimistically, some in Washington think the impeachment inquiry could actually work in our favor to pass appropriations before the end of the year. They think that because the issues currently holding up the appropriations bills, mainly the president's demand for funding of a wall at the southern border, might fall to the wayside as the president spends more time dealing with the impeachment inquiry issues. We'll see if defending the impeachment inquiry takes the wind out of the sails of the president's signature policy issue. That's certainly up for debate. But if it does, even though the House has already passed a higher level of spending in the labor HHS bills for DD councils, we'd still predict a retreat to level funding in order to avoid additional debate and time spent on a continuing resolution. Next, I'm going to shift to employment. October is National Disability Employment Awareness Month. So here's a quick rundown on federal legislation and regulations that NACD staff are focusing on. The first exciting bill is the Transformation to Competitive Employment Act. This bipartisan, bicameral legislation was introduced by Chairman Bobby Scott, a Democrat from Virginia, and Representative Kathy McMorris Rogers, a Republican from Washington. And on the Senate side, it was introduced by Senators Bob Casey from Pennsylvania and Chris Van Hollen from Maryland, both Democrats. The legislation would end the outdated and unfair payment of workers with disabilities who receive subminimum wages under Section 14C of the Fair Labor Standards Act. The bill not only phases out Section 14C in 6 years, but importantly includes funding to help state and providers transform business models to support individuals with disability who are transitioning to competitive integrative employment and track the worker outcomes so no one is left behind. We're optimistic for a House hearing on the bill, but the chances of passing in this Congress are slim, again, because of the tight congressional calendar. Still, we're going to continue on working to build co-sponsors through the end of the year. The Customized Approaches to Providing and Building Independent Lives of Inclusion for Transition Age Youth Act, also known as the Capability Act, is another bipartisan bill that once again shows full employment for people with intellectual and developmental disabilities is something that we can all get behind. Sponsored by Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers, a Republican from Washington, and Seth Moulton, a Democrat from Massachusetts, the bill would help fund 6 competitive grants lasting 4 years that help Americans with intellectual and developmental disabilities transition from school to the workforce by creating customized work opportunities, expanding fair wage jobs in integrated workplaces, and creating programs that help teach independent living and job skills. We'll continue to work to build co-sponsors and find senators looking to introduce a companion bill in the Senate. This modest proposal may have a chance to sneak into larger bills, but only if we can get that Senate support sometime during this Congress. The Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, the WIOA, of 2014, of course, is public law. WIOA, sponsored by Republican Virginia Fox from North Carolina and supported by Republicans and Democrats alike, became law when it was signed by President Obama. The law made increasing employment for people with disabilities and competitive integrated employment, or CIE, a federal priority, and it put significant limits on placements in sub-minimum wage sheltered workshops. The final regulations were released in 2016, and they provided details for implementation of WIOA in the states, including how to define competitive integrated employment. Yet we hear rumors constantly that special interests are undermining this federal priority and want to go back to sheltered workshops as the default placement for people with IDD. NACDD is closely monitoring the Department of Education since it has indicated they may reconsider and weaken the competitive and integrated employment pathways for workers with disabilities. We are proud to belong to the CIE coalition headed up by Allison Barkoff, who's speaking later on this call, as I mentioned, so we can swiftly respond and take action if needed to prevent any weakening of the WIOA protections for workers with intellectual and developmental disabilities. The next bill that I'm sure many of you have heard about is the Raise the Wage Act. This bill is supported in part by NACDD. The Raise the Wage Act aims to increase the minimum wage for all workers to $15 an hour by 2024. NACDD supports the legislation's phase-out of the Department of Labor's 14C program that currently allows employers to pay workers with disabilities less than the federal minimum wage. In this legislation provides that workers in the 14C programs would see a gradual increase in the minimum wage for these jobs from $4.25 an hour in year one to $12.85 an hour in year five, finally meeting the $15 per hour norm in year six. Unfortunately, this is a highly partisan bill, but it did manage to pass the House already with three Republican votes. We have heard that the Senate is unlikely to take up this bill this Congress, but we will continue to work on finding additional Senate support to make this bill happen in the future. There are a few other bills, just three more that I want to talk about briefly because of the impact it has on workers in general. The first is the Supplemental Security Income Restoration Act. This bill, sponsored by Raul Grijalva, he's a Democrat from Arizona, is currently only introduced in the House, but it provides a much-needed update to the Supplemental Security Income Program for people who are disabled or elderly and have low income. It increases the amount of disregard income that beneficiaries can take in each month from the current $2,000 to $10,000, and the bill would repeal penalties for marrying or receiving assistance from family members. These changes make it possible for individuals and married couples who receive SSI benefits to earn income from work, additional income from work, thereby avoiding debt, the ability to make larger purchases like cars and homes, and living the best lives possible in the community. I'm sure you're all familiar with the ABLE Act, the Achieving Better Life Experience Act, which allows people with disabilities to save additional money without affecting their benefits. The Achieving Better Life Experience Age Adjustment Act, introduced by Kathy McMorris Rogers, a Republican from Washington, Tony Cardenas, a Democrat from California, and Senators Bob Casey, a Democrat from Pennsylvania, and Jerry Moran, a Republican from Kansas, are leading the way to increase the ABLE Act threshold for ABLE accounts to include people for the onset of disability prior to age of 26 to people who have their onset of disability prior to age of 46. This bill allows more people with disabilities to save more earnings from work with the ABLE account so that they can pay for disability-related expenses without losing critical benefits. And finally, rounding out our employment legislation is the Direct Creation, Advancement, and Retention of Employment Opportunity Act, or the Direct Care Act. The Direct Care Act, introduced by Chairman Bobby Scott, addresses the crisis of providing workers for the direct care workforce by investing in promising strategies to recruit, retain, and advance direct care workers. It provides grants to increase direct service providers' workforces so that older adults and people with disabilities can have the same freedom and liberty as everyone else. We'll be working to add Republican co-sponsors on this bill and trying to find a way for this modest grant program to pass in Congress. Thank you so much to everyone on the call for your work and support of people with developmental disabilities. Again, if you have any questions about the legislation I've discussed, go ahead and send an email to info@nacdd.org or contact me directly at eprangley@nacdd.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce my boss, Donna Meltzer, who is the current Chief Executive Officer for the National Association of Councils on Developmental Disabilities, to introduce our topic and speaker for this call. I'll turn it over to you, Donna.
Great. Thank you, Erin. Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day to join this call. I'm very excited about our guest speaker and the topic today. I hope you all are as well. As you know, the topic is defending our rights in federal courts. The federal courts serve as both as a sword to advance important civil rights for people with disabilities, such as the historic 1999 Supreme Court Olmstead case, which established the right for people with disabilities to receive state-funded supports and services in the community. But it also is a shield to protect our community from actions, usually by state actors, that would deprive us of the right to full community participation. The NACDD Board of Directors recognizes our role in supporting federal litigation in the interest of civil rights for people with disabilities. And although we do not represent individual clients, NACDD does support individuals and organizations who are pursuing justice through the federal courts. One specific way in which we do this is by signing on to amicus briefs, something that we have not done often. We have done very judiciously, but we choose to do it when we know it's very important and it's the right thing to do. Amicus briefs are legal documents. They're filed by non-litigants with a strong interest in the subject matter. Amicus briefs advise the court of relevant additional information or arguments that the court might wish to consider. Today, we are going to hear from a speaker who many of you already know, Allison Barkoff, Director of Advocacy at the Center for Public Representation, who is going to talk to us about her work on a very recent amicus brief in which we chose to sign on. For those of you who don't know Allison very well yet, I hope that you will get to know her. She's a dear friend and colleague of ours. In fact, she even shares our office space. Allison is the Director of Advocacy, as I said, at the Center for Public Representation. She's very, very well schooled and is very knowledgeable about DD councils. In fact, her brother, Evan Nodvin, is a self-advocate and member of the Georgia DD Council. Here in D.C., Allison works on policy and litigation related to community integration and inclusion, including Olmstead, Medicaid, employment, housing, education, and so much more. She was appointed to serve on the Federal Advisory Committee for Competitive Integrated Employment of People with Disabilities and is a co-chair of the Long-Term Services and Supports Task Force of the Consortium for Citizens with Disabilities, CCD. I could probably read pages worth of things that Allison has been engaged in and things that she has done to support our work. I don't want to take away too much precious time doing that. Suffice it to say, she's quite incredible, and we are so pleased and proud to have her with us today to talk with you about amicus briefs. So I am going to turn it over to Allison.
Thanks, Donna, and thank you for that really kind and generous introduction. I feel very privileged to have the opportunity to work with NACDD and to have the opportunity to work with a lot of DD councils. I was just reminded yesterday as I was up in New Jersey doing a partners in policymaking session on civil rights, how important the work that you guys do is and how important you guys are in educating stakeholders and engaging stakeholders. And I really want to talk a little bit today about litigation as a systems change tool, the intersection of litigation and policy, and touch on these two briefs that NACDD just joined, as well as, if I have a couple minutes, At the end, a couple ways that even individual councils have supported important Olmstead litigation that's happened at the state level. As Donna mentioned, I do both litigation and policy work. And I think if you look at the DD Act and you look at the DD Act partners, litigation is really important to systems change. All of us spend so much time and energy trying to get federal policies passed, civil rights laws passed, but at the end of the day, if they aren't turned into reality, then it's not going to have the impact on people's lives. And things like the Americans with Disabilities Act, as Donna mentioned, the Supreme Court's Olmstead decision has really turned that into a reality for people with disabilities. It's really an important tool in our toolkit. For any CDD, we partner a lot and work in coalitions on a lot of policy issues. And the two briefs that I'm going to talk about today are probably things that each of the councils have heard about from NACDD on the policy side for years. They're issues that we have been working on. And as Donna said, unfortunately, in this environment, sometimes we've had to use the court to prevent rollback of policies that harm people with disabilities. The first brief that I want to talk about and just make sure people understand the background even before the litigation is called the public charge rule. And hopefully it's something that is ringing a bell to a lot of folks on the phone, because NACDD and the disability community were very engaged last fall, last November, when the administration put out this proposed rule. This is a rule that relates to people being able to immigrate into the country, so to get visas to come into the country, or to be able to get green cards. And when this new rule came out, the disability community really looked at it and said, this is going to have a very harmful impact on people with disabilities. Prior to November of last year, there's always been a rule that looks at, are people who are coming into this country going to become dependent on public benefits? And that's a factor that for decades has been part of our immigration system. But it was defined in a very narrow way. So it used to be that the test was, is someone going to become completely dependent on government long-term care? And for people with disabilities, importantly, the only things that looked at was, are you more than 50% of your income coming from public cash assistance or income maintenance, or are you institutionalized in long-term care at government expense? It did not include other types of benefits like Medicaid, home, and community-based services. It did not include other types of benefits that people with disabilities often disproportionately rely on, like food assistance, housing assistance. When the new rule was proposed last November, there were a couple pieces in it that were very concerning to the disability community. The first thing is that the rule took the factor of health and really made it into disability. So the statute has always said one of the factors you look at is someone's health. But this was now defined health as someone who has any type of medical condition that's likely to require extensive medical treatment, institutionalization, or will interfere with the person's ability to provide care for himself or herself, to attend school or to work. And when you look at that definition, it pretty much captures all people with disabilities. This proposed rule, which now has become final, said that would be a negative factor that would count against someone. That factor becomes a heavily weighted negative factor if someone cannot show that all of their medical care will be covered only by private insurance. And for most people with disabilities, as you know, private insurance does not cover home and community-based services. Most people with intellectual and developmental disabilities have to rely on Medicaid for home and community-based services. So virtually all people with intellectual and developmental disabilities will have this heavily weighted negative factor. They also said it's this balancing test, and what will count as a positive factor is not having a medical condition that impacts your ability to care for yourself, work, or go to school. So people with disabilities now will come into this new test with all of these very heavily weighted negative factors around just having a disability. In addition, the proposed rule and eventually the final rule greatly expanded the type of public benefits that are considered. So it added home and community-based services covered by Medicaid. That's extremely problematic, again, for people with disabilities. It also added in, as I mentioned, people who are receiving any type of housing assistance, so that could be HUD Section 811, any types of vouchers, or food assistance, which is called SNAP. And instead of making it completely dependent on these benefits or primarily dependent, it looks at if anyone has used these benefits for more than 12 months in the aggregate in any 36-month period. So really, really lowered the threshold. The community, including NACDD, submitted thousands of comments, and there were over 250,000 comments that were submitted almost exclusively opposing this rule. Nonetheless, in August, on October 14th, the administration finalized the rule, basically the exact same as the proposed rule. Almost immediately, there was litigation filed. So the litigation has been brought by, at this point, 21 different states, all across the country, a number of cities and counties, as well as public interest groups. They have been filed in courts all across the country, federal courts, so in federal courts in Washington, in California, in New York, in Illinois, and in Maryland. So we have 9 lawsuits currently going on. And each of these lawsuits are filed under something called the Administrative Procedure Act. And each of them say a number of different claims that the administration's rule is arbitrary and capricious, that it went beyond the statutory requirements, that the Department of Homeland Security went beyond their authority, that this would harm different populations of people, and that it conflicts with federal law. And the 4 or 5 of the lawsuits specifically say that one of the federal laws that this rule violates is Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act, which prohibits discrimination against people with disabilities in any programs that get federal funding, and it applies to the Department of Homeland Security. So turning to the amicus brief, when we saw and the Center for Public Representation took the lead together with the American Civil Liberties Union, ACLU, we saw that a lot of these cases were bringing up claims about disability discrimination. We thought it was really important for the disability community to file an amicus brief and to really talk about how this rule discriminates against people with disabilities and how this rule, in effect, is basically saying people with significant disabilities cannot come into this country. The amicus brief really highlighted the legal framework under Section 504 and what type of discrimination, what discrimination really means, and talked about how each of the factors would negatively impact people with disabilities. And in effect was a return to some of the laws in the early 1900s where people with disabilities were just per se excluded. You know, those laws have been overturned over time. Since then, Congress has passed Section 504 and the Americans with Disabilities Act and really laid out modern disability policy. We had over 17 national organizations join, including NACDD, and the litigants were incredibly appreciative of this brief. You can imagine that they were only able to have a paragraph or two in many of their briefs talking about the disability angle, and we were really able to flush that out. Just to let people know where the cases are, because the rule will be going into effect on October 15th if the courts do not stop or delay the implementation. Last week there were hearings in both California and Washington State, and this week there are hearings in the remaining cases. We are optimistic, based on the reports from the hearings, that there may be some type of at least preliminary injunction, which means a court saying, we think that it's likely the plaintiffs might win on the merits of their case, and we're going to stop the rule from being implemented. But today is October 7th, and we don't have a lot of time. So I'll just end with saying that Aaron can share it. We have an entire web page with materials about the public charge rule and what it means for people with disabilities. We have all of the court cases up there and the amicus brief that we filed in those cases, and we will certainly keep people updated, as I'm sure Aaron will. We are hopeful we will have some type of decision in the next week, and I am certain that if, no matter how the court decision comes out, this will be appealed to the courts of appeal and likely completely to the Supreme Court. So that's the public charge rule. And again, something that it's really important for DD councils to understand, you'll probably start getting calls about, and we will keep you updated on the lawsuit. The second case that I wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about is the United States, the Texas versus United States lawsuit. And that's the lawsuit challenging the Affordable Care Act. So again, kind of to tie into some of the policy work that NACDD and individual councils have been doing, think back to your 2017, and probably the only thing that most of us in the disability community were able to really focus on and do advocacy around is the attempts by Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act and all of its protections for people with disabilities, as well as the attempts to really restructure Medicaid. And those bills were packaged together. Because of the incredible work of the disability community and the power of all of us sharing the stories about how important Medicaid is to people with disabilities, how important some of the protections in the Affordable Care Act, like protections for people with pre-existing conditions, which is every single person with a disability, are to people with disabilities, we were able to defeat attempts by Congress to repeal the Affordable Care Act. In late 2017. When those failed, again, you know, this has been really a priority for a number of Republican states, and so they look to the courts to try to, in effect, repeal the Affordable Care Act. At the end of 2017, another area where a lot of us got really engaged, and I don't think we really could have foreseen the direct connection with the Affordable Care Act, but there was a tax bill that was passed at the end of 2017. And, you know, many of us were very concerned about the impacts it could have in kind of decreasing revenues and Medicaid. But at the last minute, one of the things that was added into the bill was zeroing out the penalty for the individual mandate that was part of the Affordable Care Act. And when the Affordable Care Act, the couple years before, had gone up to the Supreme Court, the part that was held constitutional was really based on Congress's power to tax. So after that, the tax law passed and the penalty was zeroed out, a number of Republican attorney generals, led by Texas, filed a lawsuit in federal court saying, well, now the Affordable Care Act is unconstitutional. Congress is not using its taxing power anymore because that penalty has been zeroed out. And they asked for the entire Affordable Care Act to be declared unconstitutional. At that time, the Department of Justice's position in the district court was it was not going to defend the individual mandate, but its position was the rest of the Affordable Care Act. So all the pieces that are really important to people with disabilities, the pre-existing conditions protections, the protections in terms of essential health benefits, the bans on annual and lifetime limits, the non-discrimination protections, at least the Department of Justice was defending those, but not the entire law. Then Democratic attorney generals intervened in the lawsuit to fully defend the law. And in December of this year, a federal judge issued a decision declaring the individual mandate of the Affordable Care Act unconstitutional because of that tax law, but took really a legally pretty unprecedented step in saying that the entire Affordable Care Act was unconstitutional. Most courts and kind of the canon of construction is if a piece of a law is unconstitutional, they will separate that out or sever it is the legal term, and the remainder of the law remains constitutional. So it was a pretty extreme decision. In January, the decision was appealed, and what was really surprising, and there was a change in the Attorney General at the Department of Justice, but the Department of Justice changed its position. And on appeal, the Department of Justice has said, we think the entire Affordable Care Act now is unconstitutional, so they do not any longer support the severing of the individual mandate. And after the House flipped, Democratic members of the House became involved in the appeal, too. So turning to the amicus brief, again, it was another opportunity because there were so many issues that the parties had to brief. We thought it was really important to make sure the court understood the impact of the Affordable Care Act on people with disabilities. So we filed a brief. The disability community filed a brief in the Fifth Circuit in advance of the oral argument highlighting the ways that the Affordable Care Act has benefited people with disabilities. So we talked about people with disabilities and the groups of people with disabilities, particularly psychiatric disabilities, who for the first time have access to Medicaid because of the Medicaid expansion. We talked about what the protections for people with pre-existing conditions mean, what life was like for people with disabilities when there were annual and lifetime limits. We talked about some of the pieces in the Affordable Care Act that expand long-term services and supports, including Community First Choice or 1915K, which many states have. Oral argument was held this summer, and we are awaiting a decision from the Fifth Circuit. I think it is 100% clear that this decision will quickly be on its way to the Supreme Court. And certainly we'll keep you updated. Again, we have a webpage where we're following and have materials on the Texas versus U.S. decision and have the appellate brief there. And again, it's a really important way, and I hope all of you see the intersections of the important policy work that NACDD and the disability community have been doing, and how sometimes advancing that work requires going to court. So those are kind of the two recent amicus briefs that NACDD has been involved in, and I've had the pleasure of working with NACDD on. I just want to maybe for a couple brief minutes, while we're talking about litigation, a system change, and roles for DD councils, I just wanted to talk a little bit about some ways that I and other lawyers have been able to work with DD councils in supporting the system change that can happen through litigation at the state level. So the first thing is I will wear my lawyer hat and be incredibly clear that I, of course, recognize that DD councils are state agencies and are not in a position to be able to directly sue states in lawsuits. Of course, you know, consult your own counsel, but that has clearly been my experience working with DD councils. So this is not about DD councils bringing their own lawsuits. On the other hand, kind of where I started off is the really important and unique role that DD councils have in working with their governor, working with their legislature around policies, and very importantly, educating and engaging stakeholders, and really having your finger on the pulse of what are some of the challenges that are happening in your DD systems? What are some of the solutions? How do we bring people to a table to work together? And it's really in that context that DD councils have played important roles when either the Department of Justice or protection and advocacy agencies or organizations like mine, the Center for Public Representation, are really looking to try to address big systemic problems in states and really thinking about how do we develop solutions. I kind of want to call out two incredible DD councils who have really been pivotal in implementing systemic change and around Olmstead litigation in their states. I don't know if either of them are on, so I hope I'm not embarrassing anyone. But the first I want to talk about is the Olmstead litigation in the state of Georgia that the Georgia Council for Developmental Disabilities has really played a key role in. That is a lawsuit that was brought by the Department of Justice, both on behalf of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities and psychiatric disabilities, focusing on people who were unnecessarily segregated in their state hospitals and state ICFs, as well as people who were at serious risk of going into those facilities. And part of the remedies have been expanding community-based services, including waivers, including supports for people with complex behavioral and medical needs, improvement in the quality management system, improvements in the support coordination system. And the Georgia Council has played a really important role in bringing together DD stakeholders to talk about the changes that are happening and how that's really playing out in the lives of people with disabilities and their families. They regularly meet with the Department of Justice, with the independent reviewer to share information and to really get information out to stakeholders about what the lawsuit means and how people can engage. So I think it's, you know, a really important role, and for DD councils that are in a state like that where there is Olmstead work, there really are some great opportunities. Similarly, in Virginia, again, I had the opportunity when I was at the Department of Justice to do a similar type of Olmstead lawsuit that related to the thousands of people who are still in the state's publicly operated ICFs and at risk of going into them, the many tens of thousands of people sitting on wait lists without services. And again, the Virginia DD Council was really important in helping identify what were some of the big systemic problems in the developmental disabilities system, educating families to make sure they knew what was going on, opportunities to make their voices heard when there were those chances, whether it was through a court hearing or regional opportunities in with different councils to gather information. And again, Virginia has been a really, really important voice in gathering information from stakeholders and updating stakeholders on what kinds of changes are happening as a result of the litigation. So I would say, again, you know, I think there is a really, really important role in system change for thinking about litigation and the connections with some of the important policy work that NACDD is doing at the federal level as well as you guys at the state level. And hopefully these couple examples of recent amicus briefs and recent DD Council activities will help you kind of think about ways that you might be able to support systems change in your own states. So I will stop there and Erin, open it up for questions on any of the issues I touched on.
Thank you so much, Allison. That was very interesting. As always, I learn more and more from you no matter what. I think I know everything. Allison knows even more and teaches me more. So at this time, we do have about 15 minutes left for questions. We're running a little ahead of time, which is good. So I will open it up to the callers for any questions for Allison. I actually do have a question to kick us off, Allison. I'm not sure if you know, but and I don't know if I'm ambushing you, but if a DD Council is approached by a person with a disability who is concerned about the public charge litigation and maybe they or their family members themselves are immigrants and concerned about receiving certain benefits. Is there anywhere you can refer them to get help on that kind of specific legal advice, or what would you tell the councils to do?
Yeah. So thanks for asking that question, and we actually do have some materials on our webpage. So the couple things that I will say is, you know, while both this rule is really scary, there are some really important pieces about it that people need to know, and it's pretty detailed. So one is, you know, it only applies to certain benefits. And one thing that I didn't mention in the final rule, for example, is while HCBS Medicaid is covered, kids receiving HCBS benefits, it doesn't count against them. We have a lot of families who are really concerned and trying to make choices about, should I not apply, should I for my child to get HCBS services, waiver services, even though they need them. So I think really understanding what it does and doesn't apply to is important. The other thing is it only applies to certain types of immigration status. So it applies to visas. It applies to people getting their green card. It does not apply to someone who already has a green card. There are a lot of groups of people who are carved out, like people who are in the U.S. on asylum. So I think the most important thing DD councils can do is share accurate information, and I can share some materials with you, and tell people that they should absolutely consult an immigration lawyer before they are making any decisions to forego some of these critical benefits that they or their family might need to make sure that the rule really does apply to them. We're trying to walk a fine line of making sure people are informed but not scaring people. And one of the things that we put in our brief, and we've been working with PNAs, and people can certainly refer folks to their PNAs. My colleague Erin Shea is on the phone, and we actually did a document for the PNA network to help them understand the rule and to give them some of the tools they need to help answer client questions. But we really need to kind of help people be calm, make informed decisions, and know that we are working really hard to try to stop this rule too. So accurate information, calmness, referral to PNAs is a possibility, and telling people to really consult immigration lawyers before they make those decisions.
Thank you, Allison. I mean, I hate to be cynical, but that's one way the administration can say they're cutting down on the wait list is when they scare people out of
yep.
applying for benefits that they're entitled to receive. And you hate to think
and
about
it. And they actually admitted that. So when you look in the preamble to the public charge rule and they look at what are the financial impacts, they talk about how much money they're going to be saving on some of these benefits because people who are eligible will choose not to use them. So I do think that is out there. And again, in our brief, the fear is really, we're already seeing people saying, oh my goodness, even though school lunch, for example, isn't part of it, they're going to say, I'm not going to sign my kid up for free and reduced lunch because I heard about this thing about benefits. Oh, I'm not going to let my kid use CHIP or Medicaid because I heard about these benefits. So it really is very, it's really problematic.
Thank you, Allison. Now's your chance, everyone. You've got Allison Barkoff from the Center for Public Representation on the line. You could ask her about the challenges to the Affordable Care Act or the details around the public charge or any questions that you might have for Allison. Now, Allison, I could ask you questions all day long about Center for Public Representation. So could you tell us a little bit more about CPR,
sure.
like what you guys do and
sure.
what other cases you're looking at right now?
Sure. So at the Center for Public Representation, we have been doing litigation around community integration and Olmstead work for about 40 years, and I have been doing this work since for about 20 years, both inside the government and at public interest organizations. I've been with CPR for now about 3 years after leaving the administration, where I was leading Olmstead enforcement work and had worked for a very long time with CPR. Our work is really on the litigation side focused on how do we use legal tools to make sure people have opportunities to live and work and participate in the community. So we have looked at all the different ways that people with disabilities can be segregated or separated from society and not have their right to community participation respected. We've brought Olmstead lawsuits, some recent ones. We just finished a 2-month trial at the about 6 or 7 months ago when we actually worked with the DD Council in Texas involving people with intellectual and developmental disabilities warehoused in nursing homes, which we've often seen as states have kind of moved away from traditional intermediate care facilities, sometimes despite federal laws that are meant to prevent people with intellectual and developmental disabilities from going into nursing homes. We actually see that can become a dumping ground if there are not adequate supports for people with complex medical needs in the community. So we just finished a trial in that case. CPR brought the original lawsuit in the state of Oregon, which the Department of Justice later intervened in, challenging the state's over-reliance on sheltered workshops. And not investing in competitive integrated employment. So it was the first lawsuit of its kind, and we got a court decision that made clear that Olmstead applies to segregated day and employment services. And so we're working on implementing a settlement agreement there to help people make informed choices to transition out of sheltered workshops and expand the capacity of competitive integrated employment. We are also starting to use the ADA and Olmstead to look at educational segregation, and I'm involved in a lawsuit actually also in the state of Georgia, where the state has a separate educational system for students who have behavior needs, including a lot of students with autism. And again, the Georgia Council actually has been really key in helping us understand what's happening in these separate schools called GNETs. And so we're really pushing to try to use the ADA and the integration mandate to attack segregation in all the different ways that it impacts people with disabilities. On the policy side, we work really closely with NACDD on everything from expanding access to Medicaid and other health care supports. We work a lot on expanding opportunities for employment and competitive integrated employment, community integration, and I've worked with a ton of DD councils on the home and community-based services settings rule, which, again, just to put in my always plug, is a great opportunity for systems change, and I've seen just incredible engagement by a number of DD councils. I'll call out Wisconsin and Georgia and Virginia and a number of really great councils that have really been educating stakeholders on what the rule means and how to make your voice heard at the state level. So those are just some of the things that we're working on. And again, I feel really privileged to have a lot of opportunities to work with folks who are probably on the phone right now on a really regular basis to translate some of the federal work that we're doing into reality at a state level.
Thank you so much, Allison. Again, if anyone has any questions to close out the call, feel free to chime in.
How does your organization work with your the state's PNAs? It sounds like a lot of the work you're doing complements state PNAs.
And is that Brett from Michigan that I hear?
No, it's Steve from North Carolina.
Oh, hi, Steve.
Oh, okay, good. Hi, Steve. Thanks for asking that question. So I should have mentioned CPR is one of the legal backups to the PNA network, and virtually every single one of our cases, we always do co-counseling with PNAs. We sometimes bring on a private firm because these are really big kind of systemic cases, and sometimes we'll bring on another organization. So in every single state, in each of these cases, whether I'm talking about Texas, which we did with the Texas PNA, or the Oregon case, which we're doing the Oregon PNA, or the GNETS case in Georgia that we're doing with the Georgia PNA, we always work with folks on the ground. We always try in the cases to work with all the DD Act partners. Again, you know, USEDs and DD councils are in a little bit of a different position in terms of being able to literally be part of litigation, but they are some of the most important conveners. And as we develop litigation together with the PNAs, or we're in different phases of litigation or implementing, we really rely on the DD Act partners in the state to really help bring together stakeholders. And so I've worked with Disability Rights North Carolina a whole lot. We don't have a case in North Carolina at the exact moment, but our work is always with PNAs, and a lot of the work that we do is advising them in cases all across the country.
Allison, this is Kristen Larson. I'm the director for the Nebraska Council on Developmental Disabilities, and we're in the process right now of Nebraska actually going through the final pieces to get a homestead plan in place for our state.
I know. Yes.
So is there any bits of advice that you can give? I mean, I really like your comments about how I feel like we as a council have been played an important role in convening people and providing even the funding to when the legislature wouldn't, to get the tech consultants in here to start work on that. But I'm just wondering, the final plan is due December 15th, and any words of advice, especially if we as advocates feel like the plan doesn't go far enough or that sort of thing?
Yeah, so thanks for bringing that up, and I've definitely been working with the Nebraska P&A a fair amount around this and was really pleased that TAC got brought in. And I'm very happy to connect with you offline. I think one thing that's really, really important in affirmative Olmstead planning, and obviously your work is going to be focused on the lens of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, but it obviously should be cross-disability and include, you know, all populations, is thinking about all the different ways that people with disabilities might be segregated and all of the different barriers to inclusion. So, you know, I would hope that any type of Olmstead plan, just even thinking about the lens of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities, would be looking at everything from your wait list to do we have people with intellectual and developmental disabilities in nursing homes? You know, where are we with our state ICFs and private ICFs, and why are people entering those settings? Are people being given an informed choice to get community services? With respect to nursing homes, you know, there is a federal law called PATHR that's meant to prevent people from going in. And how are states doing that? Are you looking at your day service systems and making sure that people have opportunities for competitive integrated employment and integrated day activities? Or is the default for people still sheltered workshops and day habilitation programs? So I think, you know, there are some checklists that exist that I'm happy to share with you, and ones that I've put together before. But really, I think of kind of the Olmstead plan as what is the blueprint and all the different ways that we need to advance things. And I think the thing that's really important about Olmstead plans is also specifically identifying what are some direct steps, what are some targets, and where is the funding coming from to do that? And that's what we've been able to develop in kind of the case law. It can't just be these broad ideals, but they need to be concrete. There needs to be money behind them, what agencies are responsible, what's the working plan. And then once the plan is out there, it's really y'all's job to hold the state accountable. And are there going to be regular meetings? Are there going to be regular reports? So those are some of the things that I would think about in a minute answer. But I'm very happy to speak with you offline, because I think it's both a really, really important opportunity to advance things. And I think it also turns into, if your state is ever sued under Olmstead, they're going to pull that plan out and waive it and say, you know, we're doing everything we need to do. So it can become a shield that, if it's a flimsy one, is really problematic. So I'm happy to speak with you more.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
And so we are at the hour mark. And Allison, I just want to thank you again for being available for this call and for all of our DD councils as you continue to do such amazing work. Again, if your question was not answered today, please do send us an email at info@nacdd.org, and we will make this call recording available. And again, please save the date for our next policy call, which will be December 10th at the same time from 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern, and you'll be receiving more information later. And with that, I just want to wish you all a wonderful afternoon. And again, thank you for joining us, Allison. And thanks all who are doing such wonderful work on behalf of people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Have a great evening.
Thanks.